retirement and health benefits, and so I'm saving the state money. Thank you.
So, Martin, we probably have to, it would take three people to equal what you're getting. Congressman Davies?
I wonder if Mr. McMillan could come back. Thank you, Mr. I wondered about if we have people who work a significant seasonal pattern in state employee, as state employees, and whether the overtime issue there compensates somewhat for some reduced effort at some times of the year and an increased effort other times of the year.
We have a lot of seasonal operations. Of course, snow removal is one of them. Fish management is seasonal. Forest and firefighting is seasonal operations. Construction is seasonal. So there's a lot of seasonal operations, and when you've got to work, when it's daylight and the ground is thawed, you got to work. And we have people who are overtime eligible and people who are not overtime eligible working those sorts of jobs. Those who are overtime eligible, they're getting extra bucks for it. Those who are not are putting in the extra time as part of their professional responsibility. The state's overtime level is, I think the state's on total is under 3%. I think retirement system estimated total going into the retirement system is slightly over 4%. I think the state's under 4, I think the total is over 4. So
well, I'm sorry, could you explain the 4% to me? What is that?
I don't have the dollars. With a payroll of, if we had a payroll of $1 million, we're paying 4%. If we had salaries, base wages of $1 million, we're paying 4% additional in overtime. So you know, the overtime part is small compared to the total compensation, but it's concentrated in those who get paid for it, because not everybody does. But for those who get paid for it, they, you know, where their work is beyond their control, you know, fish are out there need to be counted, or fishing's going on and takes got to be monitored so there's not overfished, fires are burning and need to be fought, they got to work the hours. To suggest, you know, that we can put another fire crew in, those are not things we just come off the shelf and we can pop in. It's, we're not hiring one person, we're hiring crews of 20 at a time. So there's work that we cannot manage in terms of just more bodies, less bodies, not paying overtime. So we're going to have overtime. It's a relatively small amount in the total picture of things. And a lot of it is driven by seasonal factors.
Thank you.
So an employee right now that, say, makes $1,000 a month, that's their salary, basic salary. But then on top of that, they work and make an extra couple hundred dollars. The SBS contributions are calculated on the total.
SBS is on the total with the total earnings based on the Social Security cap. Below the cap, yet it's based on total earnings.
Okay, so they are going to get, if SBS is looked at as a 401k or a retirement type account, they're still going to get the credit into that account, but just not into the PERS account.
Correct.
Up to the cap.
Up to the cap.
Are there further questions? We do have a couple other people to testify.
We are.
Mr. Sears, did you want to speak now?
For the record, my name is John Sear. I'm the president of NEA Alaska. I guess I'd just like to go on record to thanking them, especially the members of the Senate majority, for working with us on this bill. Some of the questions that have come up over page 3, section 3, lines 22 and 23. I'd like to just do a little history, if I could, and explain to the committee just how this whole thing works. It seemed to us when this bill was first written and presented, that it was looking at state employees, and then there was a section for under PERS. The thing is, in our school districts, we have a few employees. We have our non-certified employees who are under the PERS retirement system. They're the janitors, the custodians, the food service, those people. Over the course of the last 8 or 10 years, a lot of them have found their salary and their work year reduced. At one point, they were 12-month employees. They did their summer maintenance, that kind of thing, which typically was summer maintenance. They did it in the summer. Worked a standard 40-hour week throughout the year, went home. And as school district budgets have been reduced or at least maintained at a level rate, and inflation has eaten away at them, those people have found their work year reduced to first 11 and then 10 and then 9. And now we have a number of custodians, janitors, maintenance people who work 8 months out of the year. They don't get a full year's credit in PERS for that 8 months. They used to. Now they only get 8 months. They work a school year, but they don't get a full year's credit. They are required by their supervisors, especially if there's an emergency in the winter, a pipe freezes or a furnace goes out or whatever, and they have to come in the evening, and they pick up a little bit of overtime. I mean, I'll be honest, if you're a janitor and the pipes freeze, you come in some evening, you're going to get maybe 2 or 3 hours a week. It just seemed to us, and as we worked through on the Senate side, that this bill was not designed to trap them in this situation where here they are at basically the bottom of the financial pecking order, especially in rural Alaska. They are mostly the people who live there year-round. I mean, they're the residents, long-term residents of the state. To see that small bit of compensation taken away from them when they have already lost the year-for-year retirement, and they're not eligible for unemployment. I mean, they get laid off in the summertime because they're school district employees. They don't get unemployment. So it's kind of like, they keep getting the apple keeps coming up, and it's, the bullet is aimed somewhere else, but they keep getting hit with it at the same time. And so we did want to at least acknowledge the efforts of the Senate and the majority to work with us and take care of those few people. And so we'd like to make that clear to the committee, and thank you.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Sears?
Mr. Chairman, so what you're saying is that was accommodated by the inclusion of page 3, line 22, 23.
Right, section B.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah, is there anyone else in the audience? Mr. Bruce.
That's a good plus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jan Bruce, representing the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I'd like to express the department's concerns with two concerns with Section 2 of the bill, and then I'd like to also offer one concern with Section 3. The department maintains 48 offices around the state. Not all of them are manned year-round, but a number of them are. Many of these offices are in small, remote communities. And we have essentially two concerns with Section 2 and its impact on getting employees into those positions in those kind of communities. One is that we're concerned that the provision in Section 2 may actually act as a deterrent to someone being willing to accept an assignment to a remote community. Many of the people who might go out there, we would want to send seasoned staff out there because they are people, they have to work with quite a bit of responsibility on them. They're a long way from their immediate supervisors, and consequently we're not inclined to, do not like to send new people, especially people who would be new to the state out there. So generally we're offering those positions to somebody who is a current employee of the department. But that person may not have experience in living in such a small, remote community. And there's no way, but until they get out there and experience it, do they know how they will react to it. There are also a number of things that can happen to, over a five-year period of time, to a person's family that could change their conditions and no longer make it suitable for them to be in that situation. So that's our first concern, is someone, and when they're offered a chance to go out and work in one of those positions, currently they go out under a two-year agreement, as was outlined earlier, but they may be hesitant to go out there if they know that they're there for 5 years or they have to bear the costs of coming back if it doesn't work out. The second concern is that if you get someone out there and it doesn't work out in that setting for either themselves or the community that they're in, it's much better to get them out of that situation and reassign them someplace else than to leave somebody there that's unhappy, not doing a good job, the community's not happy with. It's a lot better for the public, it's a lot better for the department to have the flexibility to get someone out of that position on a voluntary basis if it's not working out and everybody agrees it's not working out. We're concerned that the change to the five-year stay would provide a disincentive to make those kind of adjustments if it was necessary. I would like to add that, you know, our experience has generally been that people that do go into these communities tend to stay there a long time because we generally try to pick people that are that do well in that situation. They like the situation, they're happy there, and we haven't had a situation where we've had a lot of short-timers in those situations, but it does occur periodically, and you have to recognize that the chances are that you will encounter one of these situations despite your best efforts to avoid it. So those are our concerns with Section 2. And then in Section 3, some of the discussion that preceded my coming up here was on the same issue that I was going to speak on there, and that is that the department uses a lot of seasonal employees, especially in our fisheries management programs. We have almost as many seasonal employees as we do permanent employees. And many of these employees are people that have some training in biology, but they may not have a degree. They are a permanent seasonal position, and they work for the department over a number of years, and they make a very valuable contribution. Oftentimes they run weirs, they do stock identification work in the fisheries, they do escapement counts, they do a number of things. And the fact that they come back year after year and build up a background of experience in these areas and in this kind of work is very valuable. They do, when they're in the field in those situations, have to work overtime because basically they're working alongside the fisheries. And in the case of the fisheries, they're running, you know, long hours, sometimes continuously. So, and we also have some people that are not in fisheries management directly, but some of our wildlife employees are seasonal. Some of our other staff are also seasonal, and the same kind of situation would apply to them. So these people are valuable to the state because of the experience they bring and their continuity. It would be very expensive. I think it would be more expensive, actually, to replace them with a permanent employee than it is to pay them overtime. It probably would also be more expensive because of the location to rotate a number of employees in to avoid overtime than it would be to go ahead and pay the overtime. As somebody said earlier, it's a management tool, and in many cases, it's the most cost-effective way for the employer to get the job done. I'll stop there, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, are there questions for Mr. Bruce?
My only point is, I guess, I don't think the people are signing on to your job because they know that they're going to get overtime that's going to be counted into their retirement. They're signing on to your job because it's a job they want to do, and they're hoping to get full-time work out of it, and it'll lead to such. I don't say that you're not able to pay them overtime because it's a seasonal job and there's overtime. I don't think this legislation is necessarily stopping that. It's just saying that for purposes of your retirement, that overtime is not going to be calculated into it. I think that's a pretty justified public policy position.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just respond, I perhaps didn't make myself clear. I wasn't speaking to, I realize that they'll continue to be able to get overtime, but some of these people actually do, they look at this as a full-time job and as their career, and they're not planning on moving into a different position. So the the retirement aspect of it is an important consideration for them as they look at continuing in these kinds of jobs. And what I'm saying is the experience that somebody brings to that kind of job that has been there a number of years is a very valuable asset, and it's to the state's interest to try to keep those people there for the long term. So that is my point, that the retirement consideration is important to some of the people that have these jobs, even though they're only seasonal jobs.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask Mr. Chance about the seasonal overtime employees?
Sure. Are there any further questions for Mr. Bruce?
For Mr. Bruce, I've had some friends that, of course, just 3 years now, I can't think of it, who have done this in college years and while they were training and so on. Do they get that experience, say, work all summer for 5 or 6 months and then go back to school? Is that calculated when they're out in the bush for total time? You know, they're just there counting and getting experience. So they may spend their 5 or 6 months in the bush. What is that counted as for a retirement packet? 1 year, year and a half?
Mr. Chairman, as somebody said earlier, the retirement system is complicated. I really couldn't answer that question. But there are some people that are holding these positions while they're going to school. There are some people that are, this is actually, you know, they've chosen this as an occupation, and they do this. We have people that do this year after year, and they don't. It's not a stepping stone. It's not a position in a career advancement. That's what they are doing. They're happy with that kind of work. That's the kind of work they want to do.
Well, I didn't take it as a stepping stone, but I do take it that maybe they can work for 12 years or 15 years and get 20 years credit. Why not bring a new guy in?
Do you have a response?
I don't know the details, but I can't answer the representative's question.
Representative Davies?
Well, I think we'll probably get some clarification there, but I believe that the amount of the time of service is counted by the days. So, you know, you just add up the number of days and divide by 365 or whatever they actually use in years. What we're talking about here is your highest 3 years of compensation, whether or not the overtime counts in those 3 years to your retirement calculation. I believe. If I'm wrong, I'd like to be corrected.
Thank you, Mr. Bruce. Mr. Chance, there's a question for you.
There was a good bit of discussion in the hearings in the Senate on this issue, and one thing that needs to be made clear, because so much is focused on the option being either pay overtime or hire another employer, that is certainly not the other option. If you look at many of the kinds of employees that we're dealing with, particularly the seasonal natural resource officer, fish technician kind of employee. First, those who are in the general government unit already have an arrangement so that their overtime is often treated as compensatory time. So during the period they would otherwise be laid off, they are actually on the state's payroll as if worked for a good portion of the summer. They are not taking their overtime as overtime. They are taking it as comp time, and thereby significantly increasing their per service credit during the summer after, or the winter after their season is over. Also, there's at least a good argument that many of those people are not overtime eligible under the Fair Labor Standards Act anyway, because they're engaged in agricultural work. Consequently, the thing which really drives their overtime eligibility is a voluntary arrangement through a collective bargaining agreement which the state has made with whatever organization represents them. Under the Fair Labor Standards Act, and just by the ability to negotiate wages and hours for those people who aren't overtime eligible under the Fair Labor Standards Act, it is not cast in stone anywhere that the only way you can pay these seasonal people is a low hourly wage and then a great deal of overtime. Nor is it cast in stone that the only way you can pay these people is for a 37 and a half hour straight time week and then a great deal of overtime. For those who are not overtime eligible, there are any number of ways to arrange a schedule so that the work demands can be met. And there are erratic work demands based on weather as straight time hours. Even FLSA or Fair Labor Standards Act eligible employees such as law enforcement or particularly firefighters, the law recognizes that these people may go for long periods of time doing virtually nothing, and that will be punctuated by a long period of a lot of overtime and stark terror. So you can deal with that lawfully by rearranging the schedules. Nothing says that people who we know have to work on a schedule driven by nature have to work on a schedule driven by 8 to 4:30. And that's if you're looking for a management tool, make the schedule fit the work, and it's available lawfully, and to the extent it's not done, it is available to do, and employers have chosen for whatever reason not to do it.
Thank you. Are there any further questions for Mr. Chance? Are there any further people or additional people in the audience that wish to testify on the bill? And this brings us to the amendments that we have before us. First one is by Representative Davies.
Chairman, he stepped out of the room. Is there any other amendments there that are by somebody who is present?
That, I'll ask for an at ease. We're taking at ease. I thought when he whispered in your ear, maybe he...
I thought he gave that.
Yeah, he said move them all at once.
All went
there.
Can we come back to order, please?
He said he will. Oh.
I do have to go down to... leadership meeting soon, so I would like to have some discussion on the amendments before us. Representative Davies, nobody felt competent to move your amendment for you, so we are at amendment number one.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. I move number one.
Correct. There's objection.
Mr. Chair, what this would do is it would move the time period for the moving expense calculation from 5 years to 3 years, and we heard testimony for new employees, it's 2 years. So it seems so reasonable to bring it down to a shorter period of time, a 5 year. Pretty tough for people to make a commitment 5 years down the road, lots of things change. And I agree that there are some medical options and things in here, but I think just as a general policy, it would be better to be more consistent with the closer to the new employee situation.
I respect Representative Davies' saying, but I think the inclusion of the language is definitely focused on those individuals who opt to go to a more remote location just to get their 3 high years, have the state pay for them to go out there and pay to have them come back in again, so that they can end up costing the state more money. And with a 5 year provision, that wouldn't necessarily be the case.
Mr. Chair, that's simply not possible. But under the Tier 2, there's, except for a few employees who are still running under Tier 1, Tier 2 and on, 1986 and on, you have to have been out there for 50% of your state time before that applies. So this is not the issue here. And if that's the purpose, then we might as well delete the whole section because it just isn't, it's just moot.
I haven't done the numbers, I'll admit that, but Tier 1 employees in the public safety, the 20-year system, there are at least 10 more years of Tier 1 employees. The law changed 10 years ago, those are 20-year retirement people. Probably a very high percentage of them retire as soon as they're eligible, but many go on longer than the 20 to build up more time. But there are at least 10 more years of Tier 1 eligible law enforcement employees and at least 20 more years of Tier 1 eligible non-law enforcement or 30-year retirement employees. I don't know the percentages, but I know that in the 10 years that I worked for the executive branch, for example, where we did track this thing, this is a very much an aging and stable workforce, particularly with the state. I mean, in 1987, when I first went to work for the Department of Administration, the average tenure in the general government unit was less than 5 years. And last year, when I left, it was up around 10 years, eight or nine years anyway. So you have a very much an aging and stable workforce. So while it is true that anybody who was hired or had their initial PERS appointment, that is the more correct way to say it, their initial PERS appointment was subsequent to the 1986 changes, this is somewhat solved, and that you have to spend 50% of your time in order to get the geographic differential. But there are a large percentage of the state's employees who are still Tier 1 employees, and that will remain true for the next 20 years.
Mr. Chance, will this impact, though, the past employees?
No, it will not impact. Well, yes, it will impact past employees. It will not impact their retirement. And that is one of the reasons for structuring it the way it is. You cannot impact their retirement, but you can certainly structure this in such a means that they have a little more consideration as to whether or not they will go to Kotzebue or Barra for 3 years or five.
Thank you. Is there further discussion on the amendment?
Sure, not very many people.
Representative Davies?
Mr. Chair, I guess he said that the average, I don't know if the term is tenure or average length of stay with the state right now is up from 5 to 10 years. That means 50% of our employees are 10-year employees or less. So that takes 50% of them off of those potential ones that might be possibly eligible for this off the docket right away. They have to have been since 86 to 96 is 10 years. For the high classification ones he talks about. Well, in fact, I think that applies to all state employees, right? Was it 10 years? Who'd that apply to?
If I may say, the number of which I could rattle off the top of my head was the general government unit, because it's a large unit, and I happen to remember it. I spent a year and a half negotiating with it. But the supervisory bargaining unit average seniority is in the realm of 15 to 17 years. The state trooper average seniority is well above 10 years, for example, and that is the average for the whole bargaining unit, and you have a lot of early year turnover, but once somebody survives the early years, then they tend to stay for a very long time. And I'm dealing with anecdotal information, but that information is available from the Department of Administration for the actual seniority of every bargaining unit, but it is only an average. It doesn't show the spread of who has what.
Further question? Admittedly, we don't have the spreadsheets in front of us just to, you know, really kind of to get a better idea about this, but if it's somewhere around 10 years, that means really only half of them even come under this kind of a thing. And then of those half that are eligible, you know, there aren't that many that are going to be taking advantage of this kind of a circumstance. So I just question whether putting some kind of a constraint in here on this type really makes sense. When we're putting a penalty in, that might allow for people to do natural advancement into positions that are available. And as we also talked about, sometimes in these rural sites, you want to move a senior person into them. Why should we, you know, put some kind of a penalty clause like this in there that singles just a few state employees out when we're just gradually, as these employees disappear from the system, it's not going to be a problem anymore.
Oh. Further questions?
Representative Davies?
Yep.
Representative Davis?
No.
Representative Foster?
No.
Representative Grusendorf?
Yes.
Representative Corrine?
No.
Representative Martin?
No.
Representative Mulder?
No.
Representative Terrio?
No.
There's six failed.
Representative Davies?
Thank you. Move number two.
Object.
Mr. Chair, number two would be develop a pro rata reduction in the amount of moving expenses that would have to be paid back. And that's also consistent with what we do with new employees. They're here for 6 months, they have to pay back 75%. They're here for a year, they pay back 50%. They're here for a year and a half, they pay back 25%. They're here for 2 years, they don't have to pay back anything of their moving expenses. What this would do would be a similar kind of thing, except it would spread it out over 5 years, and it would be they'd have to set up some regulations as to how that would actually apply. But basically, it would just, if you moved out there and back in 1 month, you'd pay the whole thing back. If you stayed for 4 years and 9 months, you'd practically pay none of it back, and you'd pro rata up to the 5 years. I think it's a much more fair arrangement. You've made 4.5 years out of your commitment. I don't know why you should make that person pay the whole thing back, and when a person stays for five, you know, 4 more months, then they wouldn't have to pay anything. It's kind of a big step function there that seems not a good public policy.
Mr. Chairman, while I do agree it is a more fair approach than was offered in the First Amendment, I still think, you know, the point of it is that you're trying to say that to take a position out in these more remote locations, that it is a real commitment. Because certainly by taking that position, it's a position that could be actually filled by, potentially, by some of the local residents. I mean, it is a real rub out there in rural Alaska that these Anchorage public employees are coming and taking a position out in rural Alaska, whereas a local person would really like to have that job. Mm-hmm. So, and then I'm trying to confuse the issue, but I apologize for straying. It is a more fair approach than the original. However, I still, the point of it is we're trying to make it a real conscious, cognizant acceptance of a position out there that they want to stay there for the full 5 years.
Thank you. Representative Davies, there are, of course, the allowances for, you know, ending your service in the remote location before. I did have some concern that you couldn't possibly list everything, and I guess I do agree that somebody may go out with the intention of staying for a long time, but something comes up and they have to move back. So I guess I do agree that they shouldn't necessarily be penalized for the full amount. Were there other questions?
You know, if the purpose of this whole thing is to discourage people taking their high three, I mean, it's still, they go out there for three and come back, they know they're going to have to pay at least 40% of the moving expenses. So it's still pretty significant hit if that's really what your intent is to do. It allows people to make some personal calculations then about, you know, well, if something else comes up, is it, you know, if I've been here for 3 or 4 years, you know, is it worth making the move or not? But without hitting them with the whole load of bricks. I mean, it does seem to me to be unfair to penalize a person at 4.5 years with the entire moving expenses and a person who can somehow stick it out for the actual five to get none. I mean, it just doesn't seem fair to have that big switch, you know. 4.5 years, yep, you pay the whole thing. 5 years, nothing.
Are there further questions?
Representative Davis?
Yes.
Representative Foster?
No.
Representative Grusendorf?
Yes.
Representative Coring?
No.
Representative Martin?
No.
Representative Mulder?
No.
Representative Davies?
Yes.
Representative Terrio?
Yes.
4-4.
Yeah. Amendment number 3.
Mr. Chair, I move number 3.
No objection. Representative Davies, could you just give a brief explanation?
We provide that if they're offered a job by the employees department, that they would be they could be paid, but I would be just adding another state agency or department.
Okay. Is there any objection to amendment number 3? If not, amendment number 3 is adopted. Amendment number 4.
Move number 4.
Okay. Representative Davies, there is objection.
Mr. Chair, this would essentially eliminate the purpose of this Section 3 in the sense of defining overtime pay as part of the compensation and then eliminating that subsection C. And my basic argument for that is that especially, for example, with seasonal workers, We have seasonal workers in both the private sector and the public sector, and they expect that their annual compensation is an average over all the months. And to say that just because a person happens to get a portion of their total compensation as overtime, I don't understand why we should be penalizing them in terms of their compensation for retirement. We're talking about how to compute their average. If there is abuse in terms of getting excessive overtime in the last 3 years or something like that, unfair amounts of overtime, then I think we should correct that. But I understand that the department's looking into that right now, and I think that makes sense. But if that's part of the legitimate compensation package that a person's been receiving all the way along through their employment, we're talking about the highest three, which is generally the last three of a person's career, and that's part of their normal compensation package, and because of mandatory overtime and that kind of thing, I don't see why we should be penalizing them in terms of their retirement. So I just disagree with the philosophy in here, and this just reverses that philosophy.
Are there questions? Representative Davis.
I think, Mr. Chip, I have, you know, this section is a concern, but, you know, the other side of the coin is I don't necessarily know if we'll be penalizing them for their overtime. I think the other side of the coin is we've been rewarding them for more than their base pay. So there's another way to look at it too.
Yeah.
Representative Davies.
Mr. Chair, you know, I hear what you're saying, but I would, instead of saying reward, I'd say compensate. I mean, when you say it's mandatory that you go out and plow the roads, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning, I mean that's a burden on you and your family and so it's just you're getting paid a fair wage. You know, overtime pay is not some kind of reward for, you know, for winning the lottery or something like that. It's a compensation for real work under difficult circumstances.
Yes, Representative Davis.
That's true, and of course, from a management perspective, as a management option, there's, to whatever degree that option might be, it's either this number of people to do this job, which might require a lot of overtime, or this many people to do the job that don't require the overtime. Mm-hmm. Of course, then the question comes, which is the more expensive anyway.
The manager has
and it is, I do agree, you know, as I indicated, it's, you know, a lot to do with the management tools that management uses. So there is that question.
Representative Fusendorf?
Yeah, that on some of the positions that we have in the city, I can see that, but it was mentioned about the firefighters. They're out in a given area. They obviously can't simply walk away from it. They got to be there. They got to work those long hours. And a lot of them seem to make their entire income during the firefighting season. And they build up their, well, they're calculated by the day type of thing, and they can basically make practically a full year out of that. And I think there are just some areas that just doesn't fit.
Representative Grusendorf, though, I think the testimony that we had is for the seasonal fire people, they can take it in comp time and actually stretch out the length of service, which is also a per calculation. So it's one or the other.
One or the other.
Is there further discussion on Amendment Number 4?
Representative Foster?
No.
Representative Grusendorf?
Yes.
Representative Coring?
No.
Representative Martin?
No.
Representative Mulder?
No.
Representative Davies?
No.
Representative Davis?
No.
Representative Hanley?
No.
Representative Terrio?
No.
Brings us to Amendment Number 5, Representative Davies.
I think we move Number 5.
Object. There's objection.
Mr. Chair, this would put some kind of a limit on it. So if people were thinking that there was an overtime, there was abuse of overtime, it would put some kind of a cap at the amount, total amount of compensation that could be credited for the retirement system.
How did you arrive at that dollar amount?
Magic.
That must be Representative Martin's yearly salary.
his retirement.
Yeah, but he does have a good point, and I often wonder how our upper elected officials are treated in overtime and in comp time and everything else. It seems like some of them who may be appointed in a four-year position as long as the governor lasts, and then they end up with 6 years of service because they put in all the comp time and everything else, especially true with the travel. How does that work, sir, if we may call him up?
Yes, Mr. Chance.
Well, I'm also concerned about bumping options and volunteerism, but the first one, how does it work with upper administration?
depending on how you define upper administration, but I would say policy level, director and above, confirmed officers such as commissioner, none of those people are overtime eligible at all. Good, so it doesn't matter how many hours they work, they still get paid. In this instance, I think that number in this amendment is the governor's salary. Whether they work 2 hours or he is far from the highest paid employee of the state. Whether they work 2 hours or 200 hours in a week, the pay is the same for most of those people. There are very few what you would probably consider upper echelon people, as Mr. McMullen alluded to. I would love for all the hours I put in the last 10 years to have counted as overtime towards my retirement, but I was overtime ineligible, and a fairly large percentage of the state workforce is overtime ineligible.
I'll just say what we have there. When the state employees had the option of bumping, and then if you see a position someplace else on the strata there, and you had to go to another community, would that be voluntary, or would that be within your rights? How would that fit in?
Well, I know what the answer was when I did labor relations for the state. I don't know that this is the answer now. Perhaps Mr. McMullen could tell you if there is an answer. The answer, when I was over there and we had to deal with this some years ago a good bit, is you're taking a relocation as a bump was a voluntary. If you chose to leave your geographic area as a bump, it was considered voluntary. Now, to maintain the illusion that there was any consistency between the 15 separate fiefdoms of state government, well, I wouldn't maintain that illusion, but at least the technically correct answer was a bump was a voluntary.
Chairman, could we have the other gentleman respond to that?
Mr. McMullen?
Change it if we have it.
Mr. McMullen?
The bumping occurs during layout situations in several of the contracts, but not all of the contracts with the state. And I believe in every one we now have bumping, that if it involves the choice to go to a new location to retain your job, the employee is responsible for that, for paying for that move.
Okay.
If you get bumped, or somebody senior to you goes in and you're out the bottom, and then you look around and you say, okay, well, there's another job. I'm in Fairbanks. I find one down in the Kenai, and I go down there. I got bumped out of my job in Fairbanks. I have to pay to move down? No.
Yes.
Strict discussion to the amendment. Is there a further discussion on the amendment? If not, we'll take the roll.
Representative Grusendorf?
Yes.
Representative Klein?
No.
Representative Martin?
No.
Representative Mulder?
No.
Representative Davies?
No.
Representative Davis?
No.
Representative Foster?
No.
Representative Terrio?
No.
Representative Hanley?
No.
Are there any further amendments to come before the committee?
Bumped again.
If not, left in the motor.
Mr. Chairman, do you have any amendments? I'd like to move CS for SB 150 from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note. Are there objections to moving to the...
Mr. Chairman, I'll object for a statement, and that is that I don't think we really spent the time necessary on a piece of legislation like this. I understand the timing thing here, but I don't like the short period of time that we had on it. Under the circumstances, but withdraw my objections.
Okay, with no objection, then the bill will move from committee. And the other two bills that were noticed for today are just held over till tomorrow.
Just so people get an idea, we did have the capital budget referred to us. Rather than have it tomorrow, I passed out a memo to everybody with a side-by-side summary from the governor
versus the Senate so we can see it. We're going to have it up at 8 a.m. on Friday, and I'm hoping to have people's amendments tomorrow evening if we can. So I know it's a short time frame, but I want to let everybody know we're distributing all the information. So we're going to start on Friday and spend a bunch of time on the capital budget, and I'm hoping to have amendments available as what tomorrow evening, 6 o'clock in my office if possible. And as always, if something comes up later, of course, but if we could try and compile them tomorrow so that we can get them in an order and at least pass them out to people. So that's kind of the schedule for the capital budget, just so everybody knows.
Mm-hmm.